you know, glad to be here. I think what you're doing is very important. I think raising awareness about this, having people feel not alone, having people, you know, realize that this is something very common, treatable, that there are, you know, better days ahead.
But to be fair, that's sometimes how therapy works too. Sometimes you have to have a few wrong answers before you find the right one.
Yeah.
If you could please just increase your volume just a little bit.
Welcome to season 5. Who knew we'd make it this long? Hey everybody, welcome back to the show.
Welcome back to another week of Bipolar Girl Beyond. This is an exciting week for us as a team. I have figured that somebody would take my cues, you know? Like, you've been doing this show for 5 years, right? You're like, okay, like we're running in the...
No, we don't know.
Still don't know what we're doing. All right, it's all good.
Okay, but so, it is exciting because it's been a long time since we had a big summit like this, like since season 2, and we've been talking about it the whole time. Finally got it done.
Right, and you know, and it's funny because like when the show first started, it felt like constantly people were like, oh, I want to be on. And maybe that was just COVID blues. Because then all of a sudden things opened up again and they can't find anyone. They're all disappeared.
Oh, you can always find me, Stephen.
Willa, I know. And you know, and adieu. I love finding you, Willa. I see you online all the time. And so it's great. You know, so before we jump into the summit, I just want to go around the horn and just kind of talk to everyone. We have like really cool emerging and people who are experienced podcasters, and you know, people who are international travelers. It's great. Let's get familiar. Let's get familiar with everyone. And then we'll turn it over to Amy, because as usual, if you've been following the show, Amy is the one who leads the summit. But I'm going to start on our screens because I can see everyone. Let's start with Megan Hall, the Megan Hall. Do I have any like sound effects?
No, no sound effects.
Where's my clapping?
No sound effects.
All right. Megan, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Let's clap for Megan.
Yeah, let's clap for Megan. Hey. Everybody clap for Megan.
The Megan Hall, like I feel very official. I am the host of the Inspired Women podcast. I have a master's in psychology, but not in clinical psychology, in social psychology, which a lot of people don't know is there's many... many branches of psychology, and people mm-hmm. often think that I'm going to be a counselor, and I'm like, nah, that's not for me. But I did do my thesis on mental illness stigma. Mm-hmm. I also have bipolar disorder, and I'm a spouse and a mom of 4 kids, and working on a second master's in women's and gender studies. So
nice.
Yeah, that's me.
Also, I just wanted to find social psych. If you want to hear the wild stories and all the dirt, that's the part of psychology to go to.
Really?
Yes.
Like all the wildly unethical experiments, which psychologists were sleeping with who.
Whoa.
We got all the dirt.
She definitely got into a really, really fascinating part of psychology.
Any gossip that I'm like, no, I want gossip. No, I'm kidding. I love good guys.
Okay, Phil Zimbardo
like
alone.
Housewives of psychology or something.
The Real Housewives of psychology, yes.
Seriously.
Well, thanks, Megan. As always, it's so good to see you back on the show. It's great. You know, Megan was one of our first supporters. She was like, "Hey," giving us tips when we first started, and we've been friends ever since. And actually, last year we stopped off in Connecticut to see you on our way. So it was really good to meet you finally in person. Okay. Willa, the Reverend, the Progressive Reverend.
The progressive.
Good clap.
Yeah. In the world of religion, I like to think of myself as actually stuff that's going on in Christianity in the last few years is an invention. It's new. It's not the ancient stuff. I'm into the ancient stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, let's read the gospel and try to follow Jesus. But anyway, I am the author of Prozac Monologues, which is a comedic memoir of misdiagnosis. with some edgy commentary about bipolar, which is what my diagnosis eventually turned out to be. Have another book that's kind of on the shelf because I've got this big move coming up to a location which I cannot yet mention. And I knew that that was going to take all of the bandwidth and the amount of anxiety that I could cope with. So the publisher wasn't happy, but, you know, the book is on the shelf for now.
And you've lived and you've lived in multiple places, right? You're a traveler in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I spent almost all of my ministry career in Iowa, which was wonderful. Then retired in Central Oregon, owned a house a little like Monopoly house in a beach town in Costa Rica. And that's what the next memoir is about. And spent a lot of time in Ireland, a little bit of, you know, hopped over to Italy this year.
I just love your life. I'd be your personal assistant, Willa.
Oh, I could use one.
I know. I know little things. I'll run to the market for you. I'll go pick up your mail. If you need a new computer, I'll go buy that for you. You know, I'll do things.
My new thing, the blog has developed some glitches. It's still up, but some parts don't work because they want me to fix some things that I have no idea how to fix. So I'm moving over to Substack, and I'm using the blog like a car in the backyard up on blocks. And taking pieces from the blog and turning them into Substack posts. So that's new and that's fun.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much once again. And let's introduce our last two. First, let's start with Eugene from the Cousins Trip podcast, all the way from London, United Kingdom.
Also well traveled.
Also well traveled.
Yes. Yes. I am Eugene, one of the hosts of the Cousins Trip podcast. I am a Washington native, now living in London by way of New York. have had a career of almost 30 years now as a hairdresser, which is like crazy to me how time flies, but it's my passion and I love it. And I'm happy to be here as someone who is interested in all topics that I'm not familiar with. And so I'm excited about what I'm going to learn and experience today. So
tell me, who was the best client? Who was your most famous client when you were either in New York or London? Can you say?
Most famous?
Can you say?
Well, probably Beyonce is probably the most, well.
LaShawn said she is.
Oh, LaShawn. Oh, what am I talking about? My cousin LaShawn is probably the most, well, no, she's my favorite
client. Right.
maybe not famous, but definitely my favorite. So yeah.
Well, go on,
okay,
Eugene.
Let's keep on priority. Do you know anyone from Star Wars?
No, but I met. Wait, George Lucas in Star Wars, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I met him. I got to meet him. Yeah, 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 yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's worth another clap. Yeah. That's worth.
I did
clap.
Get to meet him.
The fact that you met George Lucas. That's very cool. And then, all right. Well, thank you, Gene. Thank you for coming, and look forward to your contribution and the conversation. And
all right.
And you'll learn something. You'll go back and tell everyone in London. There you go.
Great.
Sean, the LaShawn Barnes, the world traveler, socialite.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Socialite.
Your check is coming in the mail.
Thank
you. I'm LaShawn Barnes. I am a DC native. By day, I work in the field of development, so I raise money for my organization, which is Us Against Alzheimer's, which is a very interesting Alzheimer's is just very interesting to me. I'm always intrigued by the brain. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I love the work. Love everything that I'm learning. By night, I am the co-host of the Cousin Strip podcast with my cousin Eugene, which is also a passion of mine. I actually love doing the podcast because it's focused on people's journey, or it's focused on our journey as cousins. In our relationships with our, biological cousins. But also we are always interested in learning about other people's journeys, right? We are always excited to have guests on our show, just to learn and to help us to sort of broaden our thinking around different topics and different areas and stuff. So I'm happy to be here. I too will, am excited to learn more about the topics that we're going to be talking about, and happy to contribute in any way that I can. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, any time. I'm sure what people don't realize is when you start talking about this, this idea of mental health and mental illness and going on this journey, you end up realizing that either you're familiar with someone who has had that experience, but you've been in that situation and didn't realize what you were in the middle of. Or you'll go away with, I'm more informed now. So the next time I see someone who might be, trauma induced, that I'll know how to calm them down or react to the situation appropriately. No, it's incredible. So, who wants to go next? Amy, do you want to start setting up the summit?
Sure. So we've got this expert panel. Some professionals, some people with mental health issues, either for themselves or in their family. This podcast is definitely about including people with lived experience as a type of psych expert, as a type of mental health expert, whose voices are very important. So we get these symposiums together and then we throw out maybe some current issues mm-hmm. in mental health, see what people think about it.
Right.
And this is unscripted. So gets exciting.
It does. It does. Honey, do you want to welcome everyone to the show? To the summit?
We just did that.
Well, you didn't welcome. You didn't get to say anything.
Because you just took over.
You spend more time fighting the dog. Well, if I don't, then it's going to be dead air.
Well, because I'm fighting with the dog, the puppy.
I mean, thank goodness we don't. Thank goodness. Thank goodness we don't get paid for this. I'm like, oof. Our sponsor's going to get mad. 5 seconds of silence. That's a waste of money. Go ahead.
I've just been fighting with the puppy. That's all.
Yeah. Look, we have this puppy. I know we've talked about it all the time. God bless my wife because she listened to our youngest. They went and bought this Staffordshire Terrier, and he's a sweet boy. But let me tell you, he's more work than one of our own that we had.
Well, it's been it feels like -2 or some nonsense outside. And so we haven't been able to take him out and let him run. And so, a good dog is a tired dog. He's not a good dog right now because he's not tired.
At all.
He's just wound up and he's just all kinds of squirrely and it's just a lot to manage.
It's a lot to manage. Let me tell you, it's a lot to manage when people have opinions about your dog at the dog park.
Oh, yeah. Steven's going to get kicked out of the dog park someday.
We already live on an island of 17,000 people.
Steven.
Yes, Steven. Right, exactly.
Steven's going to get kicked out of the dog park.
They just look at me, if you don't get your dog training, he won't be allowed back to the dog park at all.
Yeah, somebody said that, and I'm glad I wasn't there because I wanted to ask who's the president of the dog park. Who is in charge of the dog park that gets to make the decision which dogs get to come and which dogs get to go?
People don't realize is that the vineyard in the summertime is another thing. In the wintertime, it's small town America. Idaho, Iowa, Nebraska. It's everybody's in your business. And this one woman looked at me and can you do me a favor? When you walk past the dog, the fenced in area, can you put your dog on the leash? I said, sure. But he just likes to run the fence line with your dogs. And he can already almost jump over the fence.
Six-foot fence.
A 6-foot fence. I mean, he gets close, but it doesn't happen.
If he wanted to jump it, he he would, but he doesn't.
He doesn't. So. He just wants to play. He gets it's such a bad
this
reputation.
This is so off topic.
No, I know it is. But digress. But it's our life. Like, no, you know?
Dogs are therapists and we need to protect them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Defend the honor of your dog.
I mean, you know, look, I don't know what else. This is just our life. You know, we don't live in a big city anymore. We live in a small town. So stupid, like silly things. They're like, oh, please. That's a little. All right, Amy, go ahead. Take it. We digress.
All right, so we've got some spicy and relevant topics to talk about today. We're going to get to gaps in mental health treatment. What is there really not good treatment available for yet? Barriers in mental health treatment, the medication crisis, meaning like medications not being available, medications not being affordable, even if they are available. And then I think we're going to end with a discussion of hallucinogens in therapy. Especially ketamine and mushrooms, and the idea of microdosing.
Mm.
So, first of all, why don't we just brainstorm a little bit? What does everybody here see as the biggest gaps in mental health treatment that we need to talk about?
Well, I live in a not exact this where I am right now is not a rural area, but the eastern side of Oregon is basically rural and. Mm-hmm. Just don't have people available. There was a psychiatrist in the northeast corner of Oregon who was the psychiatrist for about five counties. And at some point, he just lost it. And he had this ongoing conflict with his neighbors. The cows got out one last time. He shot them.
Whoa. He shot the cows.
He shot the cows. And I think the worst part, as far as everybody was concerned, was he botched the job. So there,
he didn't kill him.
I mean, the cows were lying there dying and in pain. And that meant that a whole bunch of guys who were out on probation had to go back to jail because they no longer had a psychiatrist who was monitoring their drug abuse programs.
So
it's that level of impact,
mm-hmm.
the absence of care
in
rural, in all across, you know, what you all call the flyover states.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the absence of care. And then the other barrier is the cost of care. The cost of care is just is astronomical, especially because like Stephen knows, like, what are they doing now? They don't take health insurance. It's like concierge service. So you pay like a monthly fee or a yearly fee, and then they take care of everything. But if you don't have that money, you know, what are you supposed to do? And a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists don't take insurance.
Yeah, it
because the insurance companies keep screwing us over.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you get into the point where they don't take insurance. And even if the fee is on a sliding scale, like you may or may not be able to afford that.
Mm-hmm. So I think the reimbursement issue is one of the biggest that underlies that, you know, the doc who has a 10-minute consultation on cardiology gets paid the same as a psychiatrist who knows that he or she needs to spend 50 minutes with a patient. So people don't go into psychiatry and therapists go into private practice.
So, I think it's interesting because some of the conversations that center around barriers or access to care and continuity, when it comes to psychiatry, the biggest issue is, you know, well, first of all, the individuals, if they were to accept insurance, they have to have a person who actually goes after the insurance companies to make sure they get paid for their billable hours. In addition to that, if they book a set of patients out 30 days and then the patient for whatever reason can't come, then they're out a slot. So they're out their revenue for that month, which they've, of course, their book of business, they're booking a month or two or out, but because they have staff levels to maintain, you know, at the same time. So it gets really tricky and really, so that's why a lot of psychiatrists are just like, I'm not accepting insurance. I'm going concierge. But if you think about the average cost of that, like in D.C. metropolitan area when we were down there, I think the average cost was somewhere around, what was it? $500.
No, concierge?
No.
Our doctor who was going to the concierge was $5,000.
Well, no, that's family practice. I'm talking psychiatrist.
Oh, to see a psychiatrist without insurance.
Without insurance.
It was $500.
Yeah, it was like $500.
A visit.
So can you imagine if...
I was at the point where I was seeing... Gosh, I was seeing Sharma every 2 weeks.
Right.
So that's $1,000 a month we didn't have health insurance.
Right, because not only was he med management, but he was also trying to do a little bit of...
therapy.
A little bit of therapy, just enough, you know. So it gets really expensive if your therapist does not, you know, accept insurance as well.
Right. And for us...
Go ahead, Amy. We have to think about the ramifications of this too, right? People aren't going on medication, or they're relying on their PCM, which is not who you should be getting medication mm-hmm. from for mental health, because they don't, most don't have the training. Mm-hmm. And I'm part of a bipolar disorder group, and the amount of freaking stories of people who were put on the wrong meds for bipolar disorder because their PCM has no idea what the hell they're doing and that happened to me. So when I was 21, I was told, hey, you really should get some help. And I was like, okay, all right. I went to my PCM. I'm like, listen, I'm struggling really hard with depression. And instead of like giving me the things you need to figure out what I have, she had no idea. Mm-hmm. She just gave me this medication, which you're not supposed to give people with bipolar disorder because mm-hmm. it actually does not work well for you. Mm-hmm. And when I went back to her and I was like, this isn't work, it made me worse. This isn't working. And she was just like, that's not possible.
Right.
I'm like, it is. But I needed a psychiatrist instead of my PCM saying, referring me to a psychiatrist. She just brushed me off. And I had Medicaid. So like the people who would take Medicaid, they were not very common, and they had wait lists months long. And I did that pushed me off of medication for over 10 years. I didn't do medication. So
I was going to say,
the ramifications,
the people who go to the PCM and get prescribed the wrong medication, you know, it's already a stigma to take the medication. And then when you get the wrong medication, it makes you feel awful. It's like, well, I am not taking medication. Like, it just makes me feel awful. And so you go, like you said, 10 years without treating anything. And it's just, it just makes your life harder.
Mm-hmm. And, you know,
it becomes a very, very realistic calculation to make. Am I better off with or without the medication?
Yep.
Right. And
there are situations, especially if somebody's bipolar two, and doesn't need to control mania, where they are genuinely better off not taking it.
Yeah.
The side effects.
Yep.
Well, I remember
people get mad sometimes when, you know, their bipolar relatives don't take meds. And I'm like, okay, there are times when that's a completely reasonable decision.
Our primary care doctor didn't even want to give me an anxiety pill. Mm-hmm. That's how serious she was. She was just like, no, go see a psychiatrist, even for anxiety. Like, she goes, I do not feel comfortable prescribing you something long term.
Right. Yeah, but we had a good PCM.
She is. Dr. O'Connor is the best. Yeah, she was.
Right.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Amy. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that, like, one of the other issues that's tied to this that's driving costs is student loans for therapists. So you've got to have a master's or a doctorate to practice. Mm-hmm. Master's these days, I think, is on average well over $100,000 for a lot of schools.
A year or for 4 to 2 years?
Total. Like I've heard numbers around 80 to 1,000.
80 to 100,000.
Like when I did my master's in 1998, the bill was like 50,000.
Hmm. And then it depends on. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. It depends on if you're going to a public school or a private school. So mine, exactly. I have a master's and it didn't cost me nearly that much. It maybe cost me 50,000. But a private school, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And the problem is that at the big universities that can be handing you out a lot of scholarship money, those places are rare. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, we'd be talking, you know, if you could only rely on therapists that went to the big schools that could give you lots of scholarship money, we'd be sitting here talking about the fantasy. Like, I met somebody who could afford a therapist once. Mm-hmm. That would be the situation. So for those of us who went to private schools, you know, the bill before interest can be a quarter of a million. So that's one of the issues with shortages of therapists, the therapists who are having to charge a ton, because the student loan companies are on us, and that was the only way we could be a therapist.
Yeah.
So the issue of student loan debt and shortage of therapists and cost of therapy is intertwined.
So I just want to insert another variable, and that would be, you know, it's people of color, you know, typically, you know, there's a large, you know, there's a large, what am I trying to say?
Population
of people of color and Black folks who just don't have insurance and, you know, therefore can't afford to even, you know, get a diagnosis, let alone, you know, treatment. And then the other side of that is the representation within the field. Like, how diverse is, you know, are people of color and Black people able to go to a therapist that, you know, that looks like them, you know? And I would say that those are definitely there's a huge gap there.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about people of color and therapists, because as an interracial couple, our diagnosis came from a white clinical social worker, but the med manager came from a
African,
mixed race African, who was in the State Department.
Yeah.
And it was interesting about this alignment of color and delivery of care, or is it this alignment of a situation, experience, and care? No matter what way you talk about it, there is this, like, this sort of disconnect and this gap. I wonder, though, does the delivery of care really impact more on the psychologist side or the psychiatrist side? Because we hear about the bias in the delivery of med management and care in general. But is there any bias? Has anyone heard of any bias on the delivery of strategies on the therapy side and or, you know, that's different or in line with the med management side?
Well, I think one of the issues is sometimes people are treating bipolar disorder and they have no idea anything about it. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a therapist who I had to break up with because she claimed she knew about bipolar disorder, but she kept dismissing my episode. She said they weren't clinical. They didn't reach the clinical criteria, where my psych is like, that's because you're medicated. Mm-hmm. Because you're medicated, your episodes are shorter, they're milder. Like, but she kept dismissing it every time I talked to her, and she had no idea. And I think, so one of the issues is having mental health professionals who are not familiar with some mental health disorders, but treat them anyways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know what? It's interesting because, like, we're on an island and there's not a lot of care available on the island. And so to get around the fact of going off the island every week or 2 weeks to see a therapist, I started looking into, like, telehealth therapy. And, like, you look at these therapists and they can choose what they're specializing in. And it's like, they specialize in everything. And it's like, you don't specialize in everything. I know you're not specialized in everything. You know, and it's like, it just feels like they just checkmark all the boxes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't believe you. I don't believe that you are specialized in schizophrenia and bipolar and anxiety and this and that. It's like, I just don't buy it. And so it is.
And
it's hard to know.
And marriage therapy and every other thing.
Yeah.
Well, and so to go back to LaShawn's point about with care, when it comes to, you add in the X factor of being a person of color, I mean, quite frankly, I could probably go to any therapist just based on my own personality and person. But if I really wanted to deal with some stuff, like growing up intrinsically D.C., the nuances of growing up in Washington, D.C., in a city in its cultural makeup, I may want someone who understands that not only from a just a racial standpoint, but also from just a cultural standpoint, too, because it is unique. It was unique. It continues to be a unique place to live. But at the same, so would you really, if I went to like Willow, I went to Megan, you're my therapist, and I explained to you these nuances of having family members who are complex, either very educated, well-off, very uneducated, well-off, creating this toxic situation that for generations continues to play out. You would have to even yourself grown up in that situation, which I know you, Megan, I know you have, you did grow up in that kind of situation. But if you were just like any suburban Caucasian person, could you fundamentally really understand where I was coming from? Like, other than academically. Like, well, when I worked at a day school and the psychiatrist student said, you know, well, he is black. He did grow up in the city, so he's inherently more aggressive than the other kids. Meaning, but he was, his parents both were educated, hardworking.
They were like doctors and lawyers or something
well,
like that.
Well, yeah, firemen, like lieutenants in the fire department, high-ranking government officials, but they happen to live in a black part of Boston. And so the conversation came around, oh, he was black, so he's inherently, he roughhouses more. When I looked at these other kids who were Caucasian, they were doing the same thing. So when it comes to how we even train our therapists, the background, I mean, you know, it's such a wonderful conversation to kind of open that flower up, because it's not in a us versus them kind of way. It's in a way, how do I get the best care? Could you do it? Absolutely. And I think if we had the same lifestyle, which, you know, like I've heard Megan talk, I could probably go to Megan and be just as well. But if I tried to go to a normal suburban person that was a therapist, like I could probably go to Willa, because Willa, you've had some hard knocks. Like, you know.
Yeah, I'm not a suburban person.
Right.
And there's some things I could really relate to. But honestly, I ought to be paying you tuition. if you're coming to me for therapy.
Right. Well, and that's very true because like, okay, like Sunny. Sunny was perfect for me.
Right.
Sunny wouldn't have worked for you.
Really? In what way?
Because she doesn't she's not rough and tumble like.
Well, I'm not rough and tumble, but you know.
But she didn't grow up in a city.
She didn't have grit. She didn't have street grit.
Yeah.
Right.
She didn't grow up in a city. She was a suburban white woman. And it was like, it worked for me.
Right.
But I don't think she would have been able to help you, but not connect with you on the level that you would want to connect with.
Right. Like, I couldn't talk chicken and mumbo sauce with her like I could if it was a black person from D.C.
Yeah. Like, I don't know why you're talking about chicken and mumbo sauce in therapy, but.
Well, it comes up. You never know.
It comes up.
But I think you introduced an important point, though, because the cultural bias is that, you know, and this spans the medical industry, period, right? The cultural biases, and that's why education is just so important. And the education, you know, like when therapists or whomever are getting educated in the field, like somebody needs to take a look at the curriculum, right? To say, listen, this we need to make sure that we are educating people who want to be therapists on, you know, cultural biases and all of that stuff. So, you know, it pans out to be, you know, unfortunate on the part of the patient because, you know, you're meeting a therapist and they already come with these, you know, sort of biases and treat you based upon those. So, and it's not the patient's responsibility to educate the therapist. So, you know, again, just another layer of, you know, gap in there.
And I think it would also help. I mean, the more people of color you have teaching these classes, the better that would get too, right? Mm-hmm. And so you don't have a lot of people of color teaching these classes. And so you don't get to hear their side of the story and you don't get to relate to them in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and how LaShawn and I met many years ago was at the American Council on Education in D.C., the advocacy organization for all higher ed. And one interesting thing was always, like, you know, extending and widening opportunities for people of color in the classroom for this very reason. When you're talking about real empirical outcomes, the outcomes is in the, becomes the delivery of care. What are, you know, institutions of higher learning producing, you know, to deliver the care that people need? And there's chronic gaps still, chronic gaps.
Mm-hmm. And that also goes.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Steve. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rebecca.
No, go.
No, I was about to say it's interesting you mentioned that point in time because it was also around the time when, you know, DEI was, you know, sort of the trending thing when nobody knew what it was and didn't know how to apply it or what it meant in the, you know, grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm. And, so I lost my point just that quick, but I when you mentioned that, that's what it made me think of. You know, DEI was the acronym that was being tossed around, and
I was gonna say you had all these progressive people, so-called progressive people, or across the spectrum, who were talking about diversity and inclusion in institutions of higher learning, but I don't think anyone was really successfully like making the point that this has real world consequences. Like, this is more than diversity feels good in a classroom. It is, there are real world outcomes that if you don't have people who understand rural Appalachian white communities, rural Appalachian black communities, Southern black, Southern white, you know, Western white, you know, if you don't have people who understand the nuances of culture around the country, you're going to have gaps in care because who's going to trust you? You know, if I'm an Appalachian person and I grew up in Appalachia, am I going to just trust some fancy psychologist? That's going to be like, no, I'm just, you know, I'll sit here, I'll do the things that worked for my grandparents and whatever those things, some are good, some bad, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of this, I mean, what do you think the ramifications are going to be that some states are outlawing DEI in higher education, in schools, in elementary, high school, middle school, but also like Florida, literally higher education, it is being outlawed. Like, this is just going to make the gap that you're talking about much worse.
Well, very much so.
It's a problem on the client end, but it's also a problem on the provider end. And I mean, the thing with Florida means that people in Florida are not getting an education about the world. They have to live in a bubble because they're incompetent outside of that bubble. It's the irony. I mean, it was the argument that the Supreme Court did not buy, but that the quality of everybody's education improves when everybody is there. So I'm not, you know, I don't know Appalachia, but one would hope that I would know that I don't know Appalachia. I have to be able to acknowledge my gaps and be willing to learn.
Right. Well, I think there was a something that, and this is not to veer off on that topic in higher education in terms of admissions and that discussion, because that's a great discussion. And it might be something that's worth having on another show, another time. But one thing that it does lend itself to is when we talk about diversity through shared purpose. And, you know, I talk about, like, if you have students that are writing about their shared experiences, you can almost achieve the same level of diversity in the classroom than not. I mean, and this is back at Harvard's sort of admissions policy, and I'm very critical of Harvard's admissions process, and for that reason, because it was easily picked apart. I mean, it's like these are smart people who created something that was easily picked apart. And this has real world consequences. So if you step back and say, well, how do we admit more students with real world experiences that are diverse and they can talk about overcoming adversity? You know, then you can have people that are representative of different aspects of society. And it's not as hard. It's not as easy to litigate against that, because it's kind of hard to say, well, I don't want you talking about your shared experience or your overcoming adversity. Well, that's the whole point of education. But then also, you talk about the economic impact on this. You're going to have a whole lot of people who are mentally not prepared to enter into the stressors of a modern society if they are not duly prepared to either deliver care to those students, those citizens, or those citizens don't feel confident that you can help them out. On any level. So that's a huge gap.
So what would any of you like to see happen? Like, for me, as somebody who like is chronically addicted to teaching intro to psych, and I teach at a primarily minority school. So, you know, for a long time, I've been looking at the histories where I could find anything about where I could add in real life experiences that would help kind of the textbook stuff actually relate more to my students, including, you know, finding some really interesting articles on the more indigenous roots of a lot of the ideas that we think of as Westerner, Western. So like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is a whole mess anyway, actually comes from a Blackfoot Native American spiritual tradition. OCD was first identified as a mental health problem and a medical problem in the year 400 in the Middle East. So even a lot of the ideas that we think of as Western often came from societies that were indigenous, that were people of color. And that's something that's not being mentioned. I'm kind of proud because like the school I went to and one of the other professional schools, grad schools in Chicago, they've started online junior and senior year programs that are specifically designed to be, you know, for working families, for people who can't drop everything to go get a master's or a doctorate. And the community college that I work at has a transfer center whose only job is to get them into their next school. And they're hooked up with these online junior and senior year programs where there are specific standards you have to meet, but if you meet those standards, you are guaranteed admission to the next level. So if somebody wanted to do this, you know, go all the way to the doctorate, maybe they still have to figure out how to pay for it, which is a huge, huge barrier for them. But if they meet the standards, they're guaranteed admission. That doctorate is now within their reach academically in a way that it never has been before. So that's one solution that we're trying here. And believe me, they're hearing about that from the first day of class in my classes. That there are actually schools out there in this city, easy walking distance from here, that are trying to recruit you. And they're doing this to make that easier.
Sure.
And I'm also honest with them about this being a, you know, expensive private school that doesn't have a lot of scholarship funding. So they're going to have to hunt down their own scholarships. But
well, you know, Amy, I know you're leading this, but as a practitioner of your craft and also an educator in your craft, you have to, with your faculty and team, be talking about what's the real world impact? What data will be produced from where we are in higher ed right now and where the craft is right now as well. And I don't know if there's synergy between the two at this point to produce any kind of outcome that we would all say, oh, I'm confident in 20 years, our society is going to be a healthier society. I'm asking like how you feel about that. Or what is that? Like, am I tracking? Or like, what's the conversations behind the scenes?
No, because I mean, we still have, I mean, the other thing that's here, obviously, is a very justified distrust of the mental health field in different ways. And that has to be healed. So you can graduate all of the therapists of color, therapists from other underrepresented groups that you mm-hmm. can, but you still have to find a way to go to those groups and build the trust. So I feel like that's a big thing that has to be done. And I know at least here in Chicago, a lot of that is kind of the legacy of DCFS, of children being taken away from families of color, taken away and separated from their culture is one of the biggest things that is driving that lack of trust.
So, I'll
and so of course,
out.
There's kind of the unofficial foster system where you know your kids are going to get taken away, so you kind of slide them over to a relative to stay with them, maybe go to a better school if that relative lives in a neighborhood that can get the kids into a better school, to try and protect those children from being taken from their family and their culture if something goes wrong in one family. So,
well,
let me take a sharp veer to the, you know, if it's to the right or to the left.
in another direction.
You know, in my church, and I think in a lot of liturgical or mainline Christian churches, there we don't have the clergy to serve congregations. The economic model has fallen apart. And so to some extent, we're doing the thing you were talking about of distance learning. And that is erasing some barriers. As far as the cultural barriers are concerned, the part of the church that I was working with was called Mutual Ministry. And I developed a program that had teams within a congregation raised up to be spiritual leaders. They trained themselves in a team setting with, you know, there was a curriculum and but it was a we drink from our own wells kind of model.
You know, I think it's a huge opportunity.
Stress, you know, if mental health could ever get well, there are models where that's being used in mental health. The Nigerian psychiatrist who just trained grandmas to sit on a bench, and he would prescribe, he would tell people, you know, you go spend half an hour with grandma.
That's brilliant.
So, you know, to train, we need mental health care delivered within our own communities.
Right. In the ways that those communities understand support.
Right.
I totally agree, because I think that, like, you know, when I've seen therapists that I would prefer personally a faith therapist personally, and someone with a mature faith. Like, I don't want someone who like, you know, who is like 45 years behind and doesn't understand the proper articulation or interpretation of scripture. And, you know, but, you know, like, I want someone who has a mature faith. You know, I'd have to sit with someone like a Willow to, you know, to talk about faith in the intersection of mental health versus someone who's just like, well, son, we're going to sit down and we're just going to pray for you and we're going to pray the demons out of you. And, you know, do I think there's a spiritual aspect of all of this? Absolutely. But, like, you know, when it comes to faith, you want someone that has a mature faith as well and is not discriminating against people, you know, in their in their therapy sessions.
Well, that's another issue in therapy and psychiatry. That, you know, there is this fig leaf in the DSM that religious belief, if it's appropriate to that person's culture, is not delusional, but like barely not delusional. It's like, I'm just going to bracket this and not worry about the fact that this person wants to talk about Jesus. So you got that on one side. I suspect that the acculturation that happens in psychiatry and possibly in clinical psych as well, just doesn't have anything to do with mature faith. And then on the other side, you got the kind of people you were talking about, Stephen, who think that if they've got the REV in front of their name, that they know how to do mental health work.
Yeah, no, yeah, you don't, because you could really scar.
My therapist, it just has happened, have been former Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
So we have we do have a cultural understanding, though sometimes that they left long enough, like I spend time in a therapy session talking about what has happened to the church since Vatican II,
mm-hmm.
Which is a long time ago. But, my faith is not taken to be hostile. There's not a hostile or a reserved or let's talk around this issue in my therapy, but that I feel kind of fortunate as far as that goes.
That's a good point. It's very true. I could probably stay on this for a long time, but Amy, I'm sure you want to move the ball.
Yeah, I suppose we should move on. We do this at every single seminar like this.
Every single one.
You know what?
And we'll be pushing three topics into the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if we need to schedule, if we need to schedule another couple weekends away to do another two parts, let's do it.
Yeah, so let's see. Where are we? Medication crisis.
Uh-oh.
Cost of meds, availability of meds, some of the meds that are not realistically available right now. What are everybody's experiences?
So I just want to add that in one of the groups, this is one of the reasons why I brought this up. Somebody sat there and they said, does anywhere know where I can get prescription help? My deductible is going to reset and my meds are running $560 a month. I don't know what I'm going to do. And that's cheap, $560 a month. Because like my medication, if we didn't have insurance, is like $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's a lot.
That is not unusual.
It's also a shortage, right?
Yep.
Not just the cost. It's like my son has ADHD meds, and I shared earlier as like the generic, it was out of stock. Like, and so I had to get him the name brand, which we fortunately have health insurance, but the name brand of his ADHD meds is off the chain. Like if I had to pay out of pocket for it, yeah, you're talking about thousands of dollars there.
Yep.
And my copay was much higher because it was name brand, but I'm like, you're not, he needs it like to function.
And that's the problem that I have is I'm on Vralar, and Vralar is not generic yet. Because it's
very
a new drug.
Expensive.
And it's very expensive. And we went through this before when I was first diagnosed and we were on and I was on just Lamictal or Lamotrin. That was not a generic yet either. And so that was really expensive because these drug companies. These drugs companies do this thing where they get to not be generic for like so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with Vralar, it's like 5 years.
Patent, and the patent has to expire before
exactly.
anybody can make it generic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's actually how we got Seraphim for premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's basically pink Prozac. There's no significant difference between Seraphim and Prozac. And when Prozac went off patent and people could make all these generics, the company wanted to find another way to market that med that people couldn't compete with. So they basically turned Prozac pink, made some other minor adjustments to it that didn't really affect how it worked. And then all of a sudden, the diagnosis of premenstrual dysphoric disorder was everywhere at the same time pink Prozac came out to treat it.
Am I going to have to reprint my book in a different color?
Does this go into sort of that old thought of like hysteria for women?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, it's related.
It's unbelievable. You know, it's like it's unbelievable with what men do, like what we do. Mm-hmm. I'm always embarrassed by my species, I swear. Mm-hmm. I just am.
I got really funny stories about hysteria, too. They're slightly inappropriate.
No, go ahead. Do tell. Do tell. I like inappropriate.
So way back in the Victorian era, yeah. Apparently some doctors discovered that they could treat hysteria by releasing some psychical, what they were pleased to call psychical energy, but they mean psychological. You know, the whole kind of Freudian idea of stuff just kind of builds up and builds up inside you until something has to release. And they discovered that if they palpitated a certain part of a woman's body between her legs, there would be a release of this psychical energy and she would feel much better. And women were lining up around the block for this fix for their hysteria.
They must have really bad partners, I'll tell you.
So, obviously, although they either didn't know it or wouldn't admit it, they were just giving the woman an orgasm.
Yeah. Well, that's
in the medical office to treat her anxiety, which worked fine. But the doctor's hands were getting really, really tired. They were getting hand cramps from this.
And that's where...
This is true. This is historically verifiable, right, Rebecca?
And that's where vibrators come from.
Exactly. The vibrator was originally a sort of psychoanalytic treatment because the doctor's hands were getting too cramped from giving people orgasms to treat their anxiety, hence vibrator.
Yep.
I think in a patriarchal society, that was just our way of making men feel better about their lack of skills, honestly.
Well, at least we got something out of it.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Wow.
So,
Eugene is so quiet. What say you, Eugene?
This is probably not the point at which you want to interject.
Well, that was at a point where heroin and cocaine were legit medications.
Yeah, there was a point where heroin and cocaine were the medications.
So imagine if you've got anxiety and your doctor is giving you cocaine and vibrators. Something that actually happened for a while.
That sounds like a good Saturday night. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking.
And from personal experience, I can tell you cocaine's not good for bipolar disorder.
No, I bet you it's not.
Definitely not.
I learned that as a youngin. I did it one time and went full-blown manic. Like, couldn't even function. Brain off the chain, and I didn't know I had bipolar disorder, and so when I got diagnosed and I was thinking about it, I'm like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. Didn't do it again because I couldn't function, but like did it one time and learned my lesson,
right? So medication crisis, I don't know how we got onto the vibrators and everything. We were on the lack of medications. Like not being able to get your medication either because it's too costly or because they're out.
Yep.
Well, and that somehow got us under the vibrators for anxiety story. Get us back on track far as the current medication crisis.
Well, with the current medication crisis, the president did do, what did he do, babe? It was something along the lines of generics are now going to be cheaper. Or generics are more, they're going to be made in America or something. What did he do for the
essentially,
generics?
He passed a law to lower the cost of generics. Mm-hmm. It did not impact name brands. I don't know if they went back and modified the legislation, but the original, when it originally passed, it did not include name brands. It was only generics. And the idea was that they were going to start, I believe, you know, opening up manufacturing here in the States in order to help, you know, get that done. I think one, it didn't go far enough. I know that he's right now running on that, which is, I'm very, you know, I'm proud that we've made some progress.
Yeah, but the fact that the name brands are still outrageously expensive, like something has to give.
Right. The generics, are good, but a lot of drugs are not on generic at this point, like Herbalife. Right.
Yeah.
And just production, the fact that these meds do not physically exist in the amounts that they're needed. So even if you can afford them, there are times when you can't get them because all the pharmacies have run out. I've got a few clients, especially my ADHD clients, that are going to like 5 or 6 pharmacies trying to get their meds.
And oh, my goodness.
Still having to wait a few days.
What just happened?
What are you talking about? Everything's fine.
I can't hear everyone.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah, it's his his headphones.
Hello?
Okay. I can hear you. You're good.
So, I don't know. What do you know about how people are, the people you know are coping with this?
Well, I'm, my therapist suggested, I take Adderall when I'm working. I mean, mm-hmm. when I'm doing a particular kind of writing mm-hmm. where the attention is a particular issue. She suggested I take it just to make my life easier, like mm-hmm. all the time. And well, that's a great idea. But, you know, then I feel like I'm taking this med away from school kids,
mm-hmm.
People whose work life really does depend on it. So I just don't take my meds.
There is a, I spoke to one woman who her medication was so expensive that she can't afford it every month. So she takes it every other day,
mm-hmm.
which isn't good for a psych medication.
Right.
So yeah, that's how some people are coping is they don't take it as prescribed. They take it when mm-hmm. they can afford to take it.
Right. That's been my experience too. And then like with ADHD, there's no therapy for that. Like there's coping skills, strategies, mm-hmm. but nothing that could effectively replace medication. So clients are coming in like, okay, I can't get my medicine for a few days.